Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the War Report. Let me start by saying happy Father's Day to all the fathers and the grandfathers and the great-grandfathers out there, and that I'm hoping you're having a great Father's Day and that you're getting the recognition that hopefully some of you deserve. And don't often get, this is the day for that, so we can make up for all those days that we didn't let you know, either directly or indirectly, how much we love and appreciate the fathers. With that in mind, Father's Day. This is the second Father's Day program that we've done here on the War Report. We've always done a Mother's Day show for the I guess four of them now, and the first 2 years didn't do a Father's Day show, and I can't even remember why I didn't do it. I've been wrestling with that for the last couple of days, but we did the first one last year, and so here we are back again. And before I forget, if you have a wish to give a shout out to your father, grandfather, or that significant male who was father figure in your life, please do. You can call us, you know, and I'll give you the number at 888-627-6008. Let me repeat. It's area code 888-627-6008. You know that's a toll-free number, and also, if you want to, you can give a call in and say Happy Father's Day to someone that's very near and dear to you. Would appreciate that and enjoy that. Okay, today's show. It came about really in the last few days. Father's Day show, we talk about the appreciation and the dedication to our fathers, like when we do the Mother's Day show. And that's what I was going to do. That's what I did last time around. But as we were approaching Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I decided that I'm going to do that Father's Day appreciation. I'm going to talk about my appreciation of my father. But I felt that maybe with some things that had happened recently, I needed to do a little more. In other words, I need to have an issue that needs discussion, needs a conversation around, in addition to the showing appreciation to my father and to the rest of the fathers out there. And so the title of today's show is, if you got our promotion, is Like Father, Like Son, Father's Day and the School-to-Prison Pipeline. How did that come about? Well, I think I mentioned not too long ago that earlier part of this month was invited or asked, requested to come back to a middle school and talk to a young man who's 11 years old and who had been suspended for 3 days, and as a result, a scholarship that he had been given to spend some time this summer, I won't say what the scholarship is about because I want to give you any clues in terms of being able to identify who this young man is, privacy sort of thing, but anyway, he's very talented, and he got a scholarship to develop his talent over the summer. And that scholarship was put somewhat in abeyance because of he had gotten suspended. So he was asked to come down, my Fed partner and I were asked to come down and talk to this young man. And it was something that I said as I was concluding my talk to him that kept resonating through my head this last few days, that gave shape to the title and what I'm going to talk about. Then there was two other incidents. When, and I've told you that I've partnered with U.S. Attorney's Office, the Office of the U.S. Attorney General for the Western Region of New York. That's a mouthful. And one of the things that I'm doing, basically, is what I'm doing is educational consulting and helping develop programs, also sharing some of my ideas for a program as it relates to the school-to-prison pipeline. And my first talk I gave was at a prison, a federal prison in the state of Pennsylvania, when I sort of gave a preview for the first time of what I'm working on and my approach to the school-to-prison pipeline sort of thing, and was asked to come back for Father's Day. This was back in late March or April, to come back for Father's Day. And when fathers have their children come in, they're allowed to come in and visit and what have you. So I said, certainly I would do it. And then the incident with the young man about 3 weeks or so ago, and then just the other day, Wednesday of this past week, was asked to come to a halfway house and talk to people there. If you don't know what I mean when I say a halfway house, when you are in prison, be it federal or state, if you've been serving any length of time, there's an attempt to put you in a situation anywhere from 6 months to a year before you're either going to be put on parole or probation or your sentence has actually expired. Put you into a halfway house and try and help you get acclimated or reacclimated for coming into back into society. And they provide all kinds of services to help you make that entry with the idea that hopefully you'll have a smooth reentry and you will not recidivate. In other words, you will not return to prison within the first 3 years of having been released. During that first 3 years, something like 60 to 70% people return to prison. And so these halfway houses is a way to try and cut down on recidivism. So I gave a talk there Wednesday. And all my talks centers around the importance of education. Either the education you got before you entered into the criminal justice system, the education, if any, you were able to get while you were incarcerated, the opportunity for education while you're in a halfway house, the prospects and opportunities for getting an education after you are out, and there are reentry programs where you can still get all kinds of assistance for adjusting into society, like if you need medical assistance, if you need a job, people will try and help you get a job. And one of the things that now I've been asked to do is help get the word out to people reentering about education and developing educational opportunities and contacts for people reentering, people who are already in incarceration, and people before they actually get into the system, the juvenile justice system or the criminal justice system. And in talking to all of these groups that I've talked to, the young kids, middle school kids, some high school kids, young adults, adults, some people in their 50s, 60s who are incarcerated, my theme is always about education. And what happened in the last few days is that when I was talking to the 11-year-old a few weeks ago. He said that his father was in prison and would be getting out sometime within the next, at that time, maybe 3 months. And that he and his mother goes up to see his father regularly. And so I took that opportunity to tell him that having been suspended, that we know from research that one suspension lowers your chances of completing high school. Two suspensions even lowers it more, and three, on and on and on. And that what happens when people we're talking about statistics now, national and regional, local statistics, that what happens is when you're suspended or before you're expelled or when you're expelled, is that you fall behind, you become disengaged, and you never get back engaged, and as a result, kids drop out, schools push them out, and many of those kids end up committing some type of offense that will either pull them into the juvenile justice system or possibly pull them into the adult criminal justice system. And I was relaying the importance of education and navigating through the education system in the world of zero tolerance and the rush to suspend, expel kids as the consequences of both the zero tolerance policies but also the high stakes testing. And those kids may be viewed as kids who will bring down a teacher's class, teacher's test score results for a student, bring down the school, and on and on and on. I was just trying to lay it all out for him. And at the very end of my conversation, I said to him, if he gets suspended again or develop a pattern, that instead of him going to visit his father, the day may come when his father may have to come and visit him in prison. And hence this title of like father, like son. And it's more than the title means more than just that one incident. As we said in our promotion, that 70% of children who have a parent in prison or a parent who has been in prison will most likely end up in prison, his or herself. So there is this super strong correlation between parent having been in prison or in prison and the child having an increased likelihood of someday being in prison. So hence the notion, like father, like son. When I was speaking last Wednesday to the inmates at the halfway house, I brought up this example, and I was saying to the inmates, you may have, since the age range was at least 31 to late 50s that I could discern. And I said, you may already have children. You may have grandchildren, even some of you. Maybe you're an uncle, and so you have nephews and nieces. You may have grandkids. And the most important, one of the things that you can do for your children is to impress on them the importance of getting an education and getting high school, hopefully getting into college, and how important it is. And what you can do for yourself is take advantage of the educational programs that are available to you when you are incarcerated. And I'm looking at these men and one woman in this particular session, and some of them you could see as I was going on to tell them about what we know of the relationship between education and incarceration. And I talked about a study that just finished, 40-year longitudinal study that started back in the 60s with preschoolers. It was discovered that if a child had 2 years of a quality preschool experience, so that would make it 3 to 4 or 4 to 5 years old, that experience had a lifelong impact on most of the children who were involved in the study. The study was an experimental study, and when I say experimental, you usually will have one group would be the test group, one group would be very similarly matched, but they would not be exposed to wherever it is you're seeking to find out whether or not it has an impact or not and how what that impact is. And we found, I wasn't involved in that study, but the study found over decades after decades after decades, and the study ended after 40 years, but they're still analyzing data. And the last report that I think I got was for 2012, 2014, something like that. And what it showed was those kids who went into preschool for those 2 years, one, the vast majority of them finished K through 12. Most of them did not have contact with the criminal justice system or the juvenile justice system. Most of them had stable family relationship. Many of them owned their own home, had stable middle class income jobs, and compared to the group of kids who were also being studied at that time but were not part of the experimental group, was not part of the experiment, in that they were not given the preschool experience. They had the national average for the time, low income jobs, job insecurities, most often rented their homes or places to live, had been incarcerated, and on and on and on. The comparison always favored those kids who had just 2 years of preschool. So when I tell these adult inmates that how important education is, indirectly I'm telling them that what's your educational attainment up to this point? Without trying to put anyone on the spot or embarrass anyone, it's in that question is, how much schooling did you get? Did you drop out? Were you pushed out? What was your achievement? Can you read? Can you write? Can you write a complete sentence? Can you write a paragraph? Can you do math? And then I do say that in other situations where I've been with other, what they call now, providers, for the criminal justice system, for the reentry programs and recidivation prevention program, people who try to get some of the former inmates jobs, and they send these people out to job fairs. They organize job fairs and get potential employers to come to the job fair and talk to the inmates, and then they send them out places. And what comes back from these potential employers is that you sent me someone who can't read on a third grade level, can't write a sentence, let alone a paragraph, can't do math. And the standard now is a seventh grade level for reading, writing, and math, and what have you. So I relay these to mostly men. In fact, it was just this one woman. And without calling them out, I say over and over again that given fact that you're here. Think about your educational experience, your educational attainment, and relate it to what I'm telling you in terms of what we know about the relationship between education, in this particular case, incarceration. And the looks on their faces, you can see it. They're reflecting back. And so many of them have not gotten an education. For what reason? They haven't even, and my point to them was that many of them have been incarcerated for years, multiple times been incarcerated. And did you take advantage of trying to get a GED even? Did you take advantage of any tutorial services that sometimes other prisoners provide for their fellow inmates, and other volunteers from the outside come in and run tutorial programs? And then some colleges and universities have programs where they come in and they offer classes that will allow you to complete high school education and now even college. And there's one case where a man was in prison, went all the way from finishing high school to get a PhD. I relay these stories, and again, I'm looking at these people, and I'm trying to see if any of this applies to them. And so many times after my talk, people will come up to me, and they'll say, you know, I didn't do well in school, and I dropped out, or yes, I was expelled, and no, I haven't taken advantage of any of the educational program in while I was incarcerated. And yes, I now see how not getting an education has helped me go down a path that has led to me being incarcerated maybe more than once. And one guy said he had been in jail over half of his lifetime. He was only 31. Blew my mind. And but now I see the importance for myself, but more importantly for my children, that I will pay more attention when they come visit or when I see them, to get them to get involved more with their own education. So this is why I ended up deciding that wouldn't just spend the whole hour talking about father appreciation and what have you, that I actually would try and create a story from my recent experience and relate it to Father's Day. And the relationship, of course, is the importance of fathers in helping shape their children's lives. Much more so than we give fathers credit for, much more so than many fathers realize, because it's the mother who usually does all that heavy lifting through the years. And especially if you're talking about people who are 40, 50, and older, when before women entered the workforce after World War II or during the 60s and thereafter in great numbers, so that they didn't spend as much time with their children as their mothers did with them, because women didn't work outside of the home. And you know that. I don't need to go any further in that. And so that's something that fathers all across the country, the world, need to know, that we have tremendous influence on our kids. Whether or not we have quantitative and qualitative experiences with our kids, that being present or not being present has an impact. And so down the line, Father's Day comes and you don't hear from your kids, or you haven't heard from them during the year, and there's years before and before and before and before, because you didn't have that relationship to the point where it helped shape your children's lives directly as well as indirectly. Now, I'm not saying anything that any of you don't already know, but you'll be surprised. And I've studied this for my entire life in terms from a sociological and social psychological point of view, the impact of parents on our socializations, on our growth and development, and almost to the T, when people talk about it, they talk about their mothers. I'll give you a point example right here, right now. On Facebook, Mother's Day come, everybody and their mother have been putting up messages showing appreciation for their mothers. Father's Day come, I don't see, and you can go and check this out yourself, I don't see a lot of Father's Day appreciation posts. And like today, I think I saw one earlier today. And here is now, we're going on 5:30 on East. And I've only seen one. And I subscribe to a whole lot of individual and organization that I'm on their list. And one thing that I did see today, which feeds right into the show, is that 25 organizations around the United States got together and came up with a community bailout for Father's Day. What they did was they raised money and they went to the jails or the courthouse and they put up the bail money. They were trying to raise money for at least 100 fathers to be bailed out in time to be able to spend Father's Day with their children. The same organization did the same thing for Mother's Day. They did raise money to be able to bail out 100 women who could be home for Mother's Day with their children as opposed to in jail. And they say that this campaign was an effort to bring greater awareness to the fact that the criminal justice system is all screwed up and even goes down to whether or not you stay in jail because you can make bail versus not having to stay in jail because you can make bail. And the hundreds of thousands of people who are in jail because they can't make bail. Now, bail is $150, $400, whatever. They can't, $75. They can't make bail, and hence they stay in jail. And so this organization or group of organizations have come together and created this community fund where they raise money to get fathers and mothers home for Mother's Day. That was touching to me, that there are enough people out there who care that they would participate in this, and enough people out there who are aware that they would participate. And it fits right into our Father's Day show. And it fits in with the school-to-prison pipeline and the whole nine yards, at least in my view, it does. And so that was something that gave me great solace today. Now, Father's Day, my tribute. Last year was my first, shot at doing a Father's Day program. And I talked about my father. I did not grow up with grandfathers present. Both of my my mother's father died when she was young, and my father did not grow up with his father, so hence I had no opportunity to grow up with my father and my two grandfathers. And so I talked about that, and I'm going to talk about that today in terms of my father and our relationship. And if you didn't hear last year's show, and this will all be new to you, and if you've heard and if you remember, just hopefully stay with me. My father, and you've heard me say this before, was a man who couldn't read or write because he never went to school for a single day in his life. His mother had him in the fields working as early as he was able to do work at 5 years old, 6 years old, and he continued to be the almost the breadwinner for her and the rest of his brothers and sisters at this very young age. And he grew up facing a life of being a laborer. He was born in Arkansas, and racial discrimination was really tough. Moved over to Southern Illinois and was a little bit better, but he never stopped to even learn how to read or write. And he was destined to be a laborer all of his life and working hard, wanting to get a job, keep a job, and being able to survive from whatever work that he could get growing up. As an aside, he did get lucky. He met my mother, and he ended up marrying my mother, and they moved up to Detroit. I said that was probably the luckiest day in his life that he met my mother, Romancer, and they got married. My father, when he moved up to, when my mother and father moved up to Detroit, and I've told part of the story, my mother was pregnant with me. She was 17, and my father was 21. And my mother went to a doctor, or what you call her, city doctor, and found out that she was having what I guess today we would call a crisis pregnancy, and that the bottom line was they didn't think that, one, she could carry me to term, and that I would be born alive, most likely still born. And if she tried to carry me to term, she could die herself. So it was a possibility that both of us would die. And that she and my father got together, called her mother, my grandmother came up, and they made the decision that she would carry me to term. And that in the process of waiting out the remainder of time of, I think maybe she was 6 months pregnant, 7 months pregnant, my mother would pray multiple times a day, and I did say this to you not too long ago, that she made what I call her grand bargain with her God. And it went something like this, that if only one of us survived pregnancy, let it be me. If both of us survive, she and my father would raise me to be a good person, to go to college, become a doctor, and go out and help people. And my father, he added to that wish list the idea that he wanted me to have a better life than he had had and most likely would have for the rest of his life. He wanted me to get an education that he never got. To him, the most important thing was that he saw to it that I got an education. so that I would not have to have the hard life that he had. That was his overarching passion, motivation, and my father worked his heart out. He would work one job, two jobs, three jobs, whatever it took. And in, I guess after I was about 10, when we moved into our first house, we were on a block in a neighborhood that was all white. We were the first black family on the neighborhood. But it was Detroit. And that's important because if you know about your history, Detroit was the capital of the automobile industry and all of the various industries that worked for the big automobile manufacturers, providing parts, providing this, that, and the other. So that if you got it to Detroit, depending on what the economy was, you could almost find and get a job. Well, my father got a job at Ford, and he worked there for 37 years, I think it was. And when we moved into this neighborhood on the far east side of Detroit, guy directly across the street, he worked at one of my automobile plants, and most of the men worked at automobile plants. All of those men, they went to work in a clean shirt, slacks, and came home with a clean shirt and slacks. And many of them, back in those days, they wore white shirts to work. And they would come home and they would have this white shirt would still be clean. My father and I, in the spring, summertime, fall, we would sit on the porch. And every once in a while, when the neighbor across the street, Sam, would come home, my father would say to me, he wanted me to have a job like Sam. He wanted me to be able to wear a white shirt to work and come home and have that white shirt still clean, as opposed to him when he went to work. When he came back, he looked like somebody had rolled him round and round and round in a mud puddle or something. It was so covered with ash and cinder from working in the bowels of the automobile plant, the foundry is what it was called. And so that he was always pointing out to me that Sam had the job in the factory that he had because of education. And he, my father, had the job he had because of a lack of education. And that's why it was so important for me to get an education. That's why it was so important for him to do everything that was needed to keep me alive, keep me healthy, keep me in school, keep me all the things that I needed to, that I just needed, and as much or as many of the things that I wanted. And that's what he did. He did his entire life, or my entire life, was to do that. And my father, and what I'm saying about my father now also applies to my mother. My father was my best friend, and my father. And like my mother, he was also a teacher. No, he didn't teach me how to read and write, obviously, because he couldn't read and write. That was my mother's thing. But my father taught me how to survive in the world in which we were living in. One of his biggest joys was he couldn't wait for me to be big enough and old enough to drive a car, because him having a car was the thing that saved him throughout his entire life. He always had a car, and he could use that car to make money, and it was that. He wouldn't say this, but it was that car, having a car, that I think helped him, what you say in vernacular, pull my mother. He stood out from the rest of the country boys who didn't have a car because he had a car. That's my speculation. They would never say yes or no to that. But having a car and being able to drive was super important to him. And when I was a little boy, he would set me in his lap, and I'd put my hands on the steering wheel, on the top of the steering wheel, and I was driving. Well, he had his hand on the bottom of the steering wheel, and he was, of course, driving. But I was in the driver's seat with him, and I was driving. And he did this for years and years and years. But when I was approaching the age of being able to get a first driving permit, my father would, on Sunday mornings, would get me up early, and we would go out to the shopping center and have me drive around a big, empty parking lot. And in the wintertime, he would go out and we would do the same thing. Or if we didn't get a chance to go to the shopping center, we'd drive up and down the alley. And he was teaching me how to drive in snow and ice. That if you're in snow and ice and the car starts to skid out of control, if it's skidding to your right, you turn the opposite way, to the left. If your car starts skidding, you don't slam on the brakes, you pump the brakes. And you all these little intricacies that you need to learn in order to be a good driver. My father was an excellent driver. And so that was those things. And then there was the times when, well, one of the things he gave me the talk, and I mentioned this not too long ago. And people, I said, not that talk in terms of sex and getting a girl pregnant or what have you. He gave me the talk that black mothers and fathers give to their sons. And that is, if you were driving a car and police pull you over, here's what you need to do. If you're walking down the street and the police come up on you, this is what you need to do. If you do these things, your chances of coming away from that incident without having the crap beat out of you or put in the car, taking to jail and have the crap beat out of you a second time would lessen to some extent. These are kind of things that, you know, the fathers do in terms of their son, trying to prepare them for life in the world in which they were born and lived in. And so, growing up, something else about my father. My father was one of those guys who came home every day almost the same time, came in, washed up, talked to the family, had dinner, and went to bed, and got up and did the same thing day after day after day. You could set your clock by my father what time he was going to come in. And I say this in that my father was a 24/7 father. And there was times, especially when I was growing up, where men would have children and they would abandon their family or have children, they'd come and spend no time with the family, and they're going back out. That wasn't my father. He was that guy who was always there, who never wanted to be away from his family other than to go to work and what have you. That made such an impression on me growing up, because I looked at the other fathers in the neighborhood, black, white, it didn't matter. And my father was like a rock. He was so constant, so stable, so steady. And I learned from that. You know, I wanted to be like my father and like my mother as a parent and my father as a man. Many of the values, and my folks were country folks too, folks. And back then, there was a distinction between being city folks and country folks. Country folks thought the city folks were basically immoral, city slickers, lie, cheat, steal, what have you, whereas the country folks saw themselves as being the salt of the earth, and morality-wise, ethics-wise, you name it. And so my father, and since we're just talking about Father's Day, he set the example for me. And you've heard me talk about me and my principles that growing up, many of my principles were derived from understanding and knowing my father and my mother and their values and the things that they had taught me. Many of the principles that I try and live by today come from my father and my mother. So that fathers can and do have potential, like, powerful ability to help shape their children. I know, as I said earlier, we give that quite often to the mother because of the way the economy and social roles play out. That's the mother's responsibility. But when you have that father thrown into the mix, it can do wonders. That's all I can say about that. And so that, back to the title of the show again, I added another piece to it just before the show started, and it was, you know, we have like father, like son, like father, again. For those guys who go to prison, they're becoming like their fathers again, and that now the fathers have changed roles with them. The fathers are coming to visit them in prison. Hence, they came to visit the father. The father's in prison. They came to visit fathers in prison. Father gets out of prison. They go to prison, and the father comes to visit them. There's this cycle, the like father, like son, like father all over again sort of thing. And that, obviously, we need to break that. And fathers can play a tremendous role in breaking this school-to-prison pipeline and this repeated cycle of, once you become a prisoner, you're always a prisoner, either mentally and physically, or mentally. When you're out, you're still a prisoner. So that fathers, we do play and can play a tremendous role in our children's lives. We're learning more and more about this through research, theory, analysis of history. But all of it points to what I said the last few minutes in terms of fathers, you play a role. And today, kids, be it adult kids, young kids, you need to understand that, and you need to give your fathers a shout-out if they deserve it. And by that, let me qualify what I mean by that. There's some fathers not worth a damn. Like, there's some mothers not worth a damn. But for those who are, you need to give them a shout-out. You'd be surprised how much they will appreciate it. Let me give you, with time left, let me give you some examples. When I was approaching graduating from high school, the year before my, which would be my 11th grade year, my father was laid off. Like, thousands of men were laid off at Detroit during this time. He was laid off for 18 months. So, it's a scramble for to survive. I didn't play sports for what would be my junior year because I went got my paper route job back so that I could make some money and contribute to, you know, the family's survival. So when I, my beginning of my senior year, my father was called back to work. And spent that year, my senior year, basically trying to recoup from having been out of work for so long. I literally went to the Air Force to go to college. Let me explain. I went in the military because, one, guys were drafted back then, but I knew that if I got into the military, that there was a good possibility I could go to college nearby, or I could go to college through correspondence, and when I got out, I would have GI Bill so that I could continue my college, so to say. I did all this planning, didn't tell my parents until after I had signed up with the recruiter at age 16 and couldn't go in until I was 17 and I need my parents' signature. And I waited 2 weeks before I had told the recruiters that I would show up for induction. I told my parents. They freaked, of course. I was only child. Like you heard me say that, spoiled as hell in a good way. And it broke my father's heart that I joined the military to go to college because he didn't have the money for me to go to college. When he took me that night to 11 o'clock to be at the train station and joining the rest of the guys who were joining at that particular time, came back home, and my mother would tell me years later when my father came back home, he cried like a baby the entire night. She couldn't console him. He was so hurt that his baby had to go in the military because he didn't have money to send me to college. That was my father. One of my things that I'm the most proud about in terms of my own self is that once I got in college, and especially when I left home to go out to California, I had to come back home every Christmas, every summer. I mean, literally, if my school was over at 3 o'clock, they wanted me at the airport at 4 o'clock and on a plane by 5. When I would come home, every day, I would be sitting on the porch waiting for my father to come home at 3:35. I don't care what I was doing during the day, and I think I use the example, you know, I'm out chasing girls, what have you, playing ball, what have you. I would stop in time to get from Crosstown to be sitting in my chair on the porch where my father would pass by, and he'd look up and he'd see me, because he always looked to see if I was there, and he'd give me a little faint smile and a little shaky wave. He was so happy that I was sitting there waiting for him. He would never say it, but that's what it was. And I did that for years, folks. I came home, except, of course, in the wintertime, it was indoors. But in the spring, summer, when I was home, I would be there. I never missed a single day. I was always there, and my father loved it, and I loved it. And to this day, I think that often as that I was really very proud of myself that I did that and how much it meant to my father. And in closing, you know, back in those days, men didn't say they loved their children. They didn't hug their children. They didn't show their affection. And my father was like that. Once when I was coming home from California, he'd always be at the gate when I arrived. And he would always stick his head on a handshake. And this particular time, I pushed his hand away. I hugged him, kissed him on the cheek. My father didn't know what to do, but he finally ended up putting his arms around me and giving me a little light squeeze sort of thing. And that was the start of he and I not handshaking anymore, but giving each other hugs. And in the last story, my father died unexpectedly of a heart attack at 59. He had worked himself to death, and he just worked himself to the point where he was worn out, and he started showing symptoms of having heart problems. He finally retired, and shortly after he retired, we're talking about just a few weeks, he died. But he had an episode where he had a heart attack, and the mother was able to get the medics out, and they took him to the hospital, and he died on the table, but they were able to revive him. When he came home, and I was talking to my father on the phone, and I told him that to take care of himself because I wanted him to be around for a long, long time and that I loved him. It blew his mind because, again, back in those days, you didn't say, I love you. And he yelled out to my mother. Junior just said he loved me. That was one of the last conversations I had with my father. He would relapse and die a few days later. And I'm so happy that I was able to say, Daddy, I love you, and I want you to be around a long time for me. Time is up, folks. That's my Father's Day appreciation. Hope you enjoyed it. Have a good rest of the Sunday. Say hello to your fathers for Father's Day. Have a good one. Thank you, everyone. Bye now.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.